Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Later in the show, I'm going to be talking about cube farms, open workspaces, and the pros and cons about them. I've heard a lot of, frankly, a ton of complaints from my clients about what it's really like to work in these open workspaces. Why the hell do we have them? Are they really mainly as cost-saving for the evil employer? Or there are supposed benefits of collaboration. We'll talk about the pros, cons, etc. And when I use the word we, yes, I'm referring to you, my dear listeners, but I'm also referring to the Napa County Superintendent of Schools, my frequent co-conspirator on the show, who's with me first to talk about your issues. You've written me letters, you've made phone calls trying to get help. So we're going to focus on you doing what I call workovers. No pummeling involved, but Dr. Barbara Nemko is involved. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you, and a very good morning to you.
What about Father's Day? About one day you can give me a little extra credit, wouldn't you?
Okay. Happy Father's Day.
That's exactly. That's what, you know, when you ask for a compliment, it doesn't, it actually loses about 98% of its value. So, all right, we're off to a great start, kid. Okay. What I've done is I'm going to give out the phone number in a couple of minutes so that live listeners can call in. But I do get a lot of letters over the years from people, and I thought one of the more useful ways of helping the listeners here is I created some composite letters that combine different elements from different people's letters in some kind of a coherent way, so that perhaps had broader applicability. And we've done this before on the show, but it worked pretty well, so I thought we would do it again. So, for dear listeners, this is what we're going to do. Barbara's going to read me the letter. Then I'm going to give what I think is a good answer, and then Barbara, you'll amplify. Sound good? And then after I do one or two of those, we'll go to the phones and invite people to call in live. Sound good?
Sounds fine to me.
Well, I gave you about a half a dozen letters. Why don't you pick a letter, any letter?
Well, the first one's from an angry person. Mm-hmm. This person happens to be a lawyer, but I don't think it matters whether you're a lawyer or in any other profession. It's a person who's generally angry.
Okay.
So, dear Marty, I know it does no good to be angry, but I find myself getting angry at everything and everyone, including myself. My paralegals make too many mistakes, and when I tell them I need the revised document by 9 a.m., they tell me they can't do it. I'll have to wait. Tell that to the client. Half the lawyers I deal with are scum. They're clever enough to avoid out-and-out lying. There's plenty other ways to be deceptive. The traffic to work is getting absolutely crazy. I give all those tax dollars, and it goes to transportation, but somehow all I ever do is sit in worse gridlock, wasting time, gas, and spewing pollutants into the air. Then they tell me to take mass transit, but that would take 2 hours each way. Are they crazy? I'm hated or feared in my office, and I hate myself for being this way. I'd much rather be like the Calm Partners. They actually get more clients and are better liked. And my anger is ruining my personal life. I just can't control myself. Can you help? Help!
Okay. Well, to be honest, as somebody who himself has struggled his whole life to deal with his anger problem, and I feel I've dealt with it moderately successfully, but not completely, I just feel like I have this big adrenal gland. I have a lot of sympathy for this person because it's just hard. People like you, Barbara Nemko, are calm by nature, and so you just don't physiologically secrete a lot of adrenaline when something bad happens. But if you're somebody like me, you just viscerally, physiologically, when you get annoyed, you get angry. It's not because you want to be angry. It's just your adrenal gland talking. But here are a couple of things. I'll try to do more than a couple of things that I like to think could help this person and maybe any of you, dear listeners, who has an anger problem. First of all, and almost kind of sheepish even recommending this, but I've been viewed as the anti-therapist, so at least I want to give a slight tip of the cap to the possibility that a therapist maybe helps. So, but first, play therapist with yourself. Is there some reason rooted in your family, not your adrenal gland, but is there some reason that's rooted in your family of origin that at least partly explains your hot temper? If so, you've got to be particularly vigilant. So when you're starting to feel angry, what could you say to yourself that reminds you than it is the way your mother or your father or your spouse or your employer or racism or sexism or homophobia, you know, got to you. What can you say to yourself in that moment that can keep you from losing your temper? Because you realize that if you really think back, there's no question that the vast majority of the time, if you lose your temper, you've paid a price for it. Reminding yourself of that can help. If you're focusing, I'll just say it this way. Obviously, science has now proven that every time you lose your temper, you're releasing not only adrenaline but cortisol, which takes a toll on your physiology. So might it help you to realize that you are literally killing yourself every time you get angry at someone?
Well, I would say you're also paying the price because your anger is only going to trigger their dislike, and it isn't going to fix the problem. In fact, it's going to make it harder to fix the problem, because when they don't like you, then they're going to try less hard.
90% of the time you're right, but about 5% of the time, especially if you've been calm most of the time, if all of a sudden you get angry, that's going to get their attention and perhaps create disequilibrium. It's like a teacher. Certainly a teacher who yells all the time at the kids is not going to get anywhere. But if a teacher is normally calm, but then in response to a particularly outrageous behavior by a child, that teacher yells once, that can be disequilibrating. It's a fancy word, but that can get the kids to pay attention. Do you agree with that, by the way, as a former master teacher?
Not really. Yes, it'll get their attention, but I'm not sure it will probably achieve the desired result that moment. But I don't know that in the long run that that's a good thing to do for you or for them.
Okay, more tips for the angry person. Sometimes the key word is perspective. You're getting furious. And again, if you're going from 0 to 60 in 1 second, your adrenal gland, nothing in this is going to work. But if you can take a deep breath or three to buy yourself a few seconds of time to gain, quote, perspective, which is the operative word I'm about to focus on here, because you want this document by 9 a.m. and the paralegal says, I can't do it because of blah, and you blow up at him or her, right? Is that worth killing yourself? Is it worth making them depressed? When you do confront somebody, even if they get defensive, quietly, they're taking in what you say and you're going to make them feel like crap. Is it worth making them feel like crap just intrinsically, or making them more likely to quit? Or more likely to go to your boss about you? Maintaining perspective is really very important. I recently had an experience where, for a number of weeks in a row with somebody, this person had been very dismissive of me, not even acknowledging my existence. And then a recent day, he did three things that made me feel like I didn't even exist, like I was not a human being. And this person had been working with me for a million years. And so finally, I made a decision to address it and raise all the points. And of course, not surprisingly, the person got defensive. But it's possible, just possible, that I planted a seed, and maybe that person will be less dismissive and more human to me in the future. So sometimes, you know, and I did, you know, there wasn't fury in my voice, but there was an edge to my voice. So I think that 90% of the time you want to stay absolutely calm and maybe not even bring up issues. But there's a certain percentage of the time, if you reflect and say, you know, maybe it's worth doing, anger occasionally has its place. What do you think?
I agree, but I try really hard not to get angry. If I had, going back to what the letter said, I ask to have this revised by 9 o'clock, and they tell me they can't do it. Getting angry, even if I get it done, I don't think I'm going to get it done well. So I'd be more likely to say, what's the problem, and how can we get around it? Should we ask so-and-so to help you with it or turn it over to so-and-so because for whatever reason you can't do it? What is it that you need or that we need to get this done, because I really need to have it at 9 o'clock? So make it a problem-solving situation that we jointly solve.
That's great for you who's got the calm thing by nature. Let me present some other things for, again, dealing with an angry person who physiologically just tends, or because of early childhood or whatever, just as an angry human being in general. We all know there are people like that, people who are preternaturally calm, and those who always feel like they're just one step away from exploding. Sometimes it helps to view the person you're angry with as less capable, because very often when your anger is not completely irrational, It's that person is maybe less bright or less motivated or less emotionally healthy or has personal problems, has a family member who's ill and it's taking a toll on her. But if you view the person as less capable than you, it's not like that person's trying to get you, but that person has issues, that can sometimes help you remain calm. Another thing, I'm responding to this letter writer. Sometimes you can't change that about you. Do you need to work by yourself more often? Do you need to, instead of relying on a paralegal, maybe you can even, you know, in this case, this lawyer, might go to a boss and say, you know, I'm really able to do a lot of this myself. Maybe I should, instead of having a half-time paralegal, maybe only have a one-day-a-week paralegal. That way, there's less interaction. That person is more able. Very often, these angry people have a lot of drive, and they're able to do a lot on their own, and it's better for them to do it. You know, you hear many people say, oh, it's better for me to just do it myself than delegate. Well, especially if somebody has a predisposition to anger, it may be a good idea for that person to delegate less, even at the risk of a longer workday, because that person may prefer that. So that's a thought for the letter writer.
I think that's a really good point. And somebody who gets angry, you have to communicate to the other person who's, quote, helping you exactly how you want it done. And the likelihood of some miscommunication, and then it gets done in a way that you're not happy, and then you're even angrier. So it's probably a great idea to do as much of it as you can by yourself, and that way you get it done on time the way you like it.
Yep, I agree. And the last thing, if I'm responding to this person, generally angry people are particularly unlikely to want advice, and here I've given a bunch. So I would probably close with an open-ended kind of a statement that empowers that person and say, if you had a twin brother or sister with an anger problem, what would you tell them? So the advice then comes from this the person who's angry rather than from me. And so that's it. Those are my thoughts about the angry lawyer. Anything else you want to add before we move on to another letter? And actually, before I give out the phone number so listeners can call in.
Yeah, I have one other.
Great.
People who are angry, you just feel it. It's really hard for you not to be angry.
Right.
But you don't want other people to see that you're angry. So pretend that you're suddenly in a play and you're portraying a very calm person.
I like it.
Isn't you, because you can't do anything about your anger. But pretend that you're, I don't know, Art Carney dealing with Jackie Gleason.
Okay.
How would you?
Boy, are you dating yourself there? Art Carney and Jackie Gleason?
I know, so nobody who's under 60 has any idea what I just said.
Exactly. You know, speaking of shows, I can't resist. I'm really flattered. The Lucky Penny Theater in Napa has just asked me to do a one-man show. So I am doing a one-man show. It's called Odd Man Out, in which I tell my stories of how I, you know, I don't always fit in, and I tell a lot of stories of where I paid a price for it, and hopefully it's both funny. And I also do a lot of playing the piano where that fits in. So I invite you to go to luckypennyproductions.org, and there's information about that, and it's on August 6th. But let's turn to the phones. So, dear listeners, if you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, it'd especially be fun if you called in if you have an anger problem, or maybe you, because it's always easy to talk about somebody else and their anger, but you don't understand the roots of it as well.
You work with someone who has an anger problem.
Yeah, but that's what I was going to say. I prefer to be people who have an anger problem themselves, because if you work with somebody, you really can't richly describe what's going on inside of them, and I'm really interested in hearing people's personal issues regarding what's triggering their anger. So if you have an anger problem and you would like to, you know, you can simply tell your story and what's really at the root of your general predisposition to anger, or you could ask us for some advice just about how we might ameliorate it. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. As I said, Barbara, as you know, I gave you a bunch of these letters. Is there another letter that you're particularly interested in reading and hearing my perspective on, and you're adding to how we might solve this?
A letter from a therapist.
Okay.
I'm successful but not effective. Dear Marty, I'm considered an eminent psychotherapist. I've won awards, and CNN uses me periodically to provide the psychologist's perspective on news events. My practice is over full. I turn away 3 prospective patients for every one I accept. Yet, I'm quite ineffective with my patients. Yes, they like me. Yes, they blame themselves and not me. But in truth, while I know a lot about how to be a good therapist in theory, in practice, I think I just lack the gift for knowing how to unlock people and help them move forward. Most of my patients seem little better after they discontinue therapy with me than before they came in. Mainly their wallet is lighter. Indeed, way back when I was interning, my supervisor said I should consider a different profession. But having put in all those years and money to get a PhD or a psych degree, I didn't want to start another career from scratch. So I ignored her, hoping I'd get better with practice. But it's 17 years later, and if I were ethical, I'd stop. I would just stop assisting clients or seeing them. Do you think I should?
Well, first of all, I really applaud somebody who would take such an honest look. Most people don't do that. They just are. We live in a land of self-esteem where we're told that we're okay as is. And so I appreciate a person who would think about, you know, stopping seeing patients if he or she thought they weren't good, whether it be a physician or a psychologist or anybody else. First of all, I would provide a bit of reassurance to this person. It is difficult to fundamentally change people. Psychologists' toolkits haven't changed that much in a million years. So I would ask that person, how sure are you that really those people would be better off with another therapist? Maybe this person really is being too hard on themselves. But let's assume that this person is right. First thing I would say is usually people are not, you know, therapists are not good or bad with all patients. So I'd ask him or her, is there a subset of patients that you're sufficiently successful with? Maybe a patient with a particular kind of problem, or a person of a certain age or race or sex or background. I will be honest, I'm a career counselor and I love working with the full diversity of clients who come. But being somebody who is a New York Jew and in, you know, fairly, intense, I guess is the right word, I'm a particularly likely to be helpful with people from a similar background. It's just we can relate to each other better. The chemistry's better initially. I can understand some of, you know, while everybody's different, I can understand some of the issues more readily that are underneath. So it's not wrong. Just like, you know, we all see, for example, that, you know, just it's not wrong to specialize in the kind of people who are like you that can really help, or the kind of person where you had wonderful training. Somebody who got their PsyD in psychology, but really, for whatever reason, the university they had great programs in eating disorders, it's certainly appropriate for you to focus on eating disorders. So I tell this person, first of all, are you really bad pretty much across the board, or is there a subset of patients that you'd be really, you know, good enough? And especially if you are still insecure, let's say you are, your relative best skills are in eating disorders, but you feel like you're not great still, then fine, lower your prices. Be the low-cost leader at least, so that at least they're getting good value received. Anything you want to add to that before I give some more advice to this therapist?
I think when you're working with people who have a real problem and they haven't been able to fix it, it's not because they haven't tried either. So you're getting a tough constituency that you're dealing with, and it's possible that they may have been to other therapists too before they came to you and weren't able to succeed. So you're not God. If you're giving them good advice and they're not able to take it, that's not your fault. I think I would probably give them a choice and say, you know, you've been coming to me now for 3 months and we talk and I give you we come to an agreement about the things that you're going to do, and then you come back and you haven't done any of them. So do you think it's in your best interest to stay, given that you don't seem to be making much progress, and leave it up to them?
That's certainly
they may need the comfort of having someone to talk to and knowing that there are some solutions, even if they can't make themselves do them.
That's good advice for an individual client who's not doing well. But this person is now reflecting on 17 years of, in general, finding most clients not being any better off after they finish therapy than before. So
but
I
that
think,
may be that the therapist's judgment, who's being very hard on himself, the clients may not feel that way.
It could be. You know what? I'm not so easy to dismiss a therapist saying that after 17 years. But anyway, let's move on to another piece of suggestion. You know, obviously before quitting, you know, training, while it doesn't it can't convert somebody who's just lacking the gift in helping people to move forward into somebody who's great at it. But sometimes training does matter. So even if the person has a Psy D, you know, I'm a huge believer in watching master practitioners in action. So maybe this person might want to watch some videos of master therapists, or, you know, or simply watching YouTube videos that have a high ratio specifically of thumbs up to thumbs down. Or a live therapist who would be willing to observe your sessions, or you're observing theirs. And if you don't know of any, you know, certainly ask of your clients for recommendations, or simply look for therapists that are highly rated on Yelp. Of course, Yelp, you got to view with grains of salt. There are, you can easy to get friends to write good reviews and your competitors to write a deliberately bad one. But if you've got dozens of effusive ones and only a few baddies, that might be somebody who's worth paying even for a session to be there, you know, to be their patient to see what they're like, or paying them to watch you or for you to watch them. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think those are all very good ideas.
Okay.
I like those.
Anyway, and I do think that I wanted, the last thing I would say to this person is I'd feel very good about this human being, that they cared enough about making a difference to the world and to patients. I mean, it's very, very disconcerting to think that you've gotten this PsyD, doctoral degree, which takes years, and you've been seeing patients for 17 years and feel that net, you're not good and you should change. Last thought, you know, maybe that person would want to write a letter to all of his or her past patients. You know, sometimes, you know, I remember, like, after apartheid ended, that the reconciliation plan was for white people to write apologies or state apologies to folks. I'm not sure about this, Barbara. I'm curious what you think. If that person really felt, after all due reflection, felt that they were giving short shrift to their patients, would there be greater net good in writing an open letter to his patients, or would that make those patients feel even worse? What are your thoughts about that? That's a weird idea, I know.
I think I'd be more likely to maybe write a letter asking them a question and ask them how they feel. Okay. Now, it's been some time since you saw me. Was the work with me useful? From now, looking back.
Yeah, I'm getting in that minimum. That would get you good feedback. By the way, one point I would like to clarify. You know, good counselors refrain where possible from giving advice. It's axiomatic and it's a cliche, but it is true that people coming up with their own ideas are most likely not only to follow them, but feel better about themselves and move forward. So while I think it's wrong for counselors and therapists to never give advice, the default should be to try to be asking facilitating questions to let the ideas, the plan for the future, come from the client. Make sense?
Yeah, I think that's an important point.
Okay, and another important point is to invite my dear listeners. If you have a problem of any sort related to your career, directly related to your career, that is, you don't know what you want to be when you grow up, or you're having a problem on the job with your boss or with yourself or your motivation, or an existential crisis about what is it all worth, or you're overwhelmed by fears, or something that's indirect. Sometimes people do, as in the first letter that we discussed. Some people, for example, have a free-floating anger issue that even if they're very bright and well-intentioned, especially here in California, there's tremendous primacy on not showing a lot of emotion, especially anger. And that if that is stopping you in your career, it's not theoretically seen as a pure career problem, but it obviously directs your career. So whatever your career problem, today you get the price, two for the price of one, the price, of course, being zero in any case, but you get Dr. Barbara Nemco and you get Marty Nemco. Also, I hate to use the word doctor. We're both doctors. But whatever. It doesn't matter. The doctor is irrelevant. All right. Would you agree that our PhD has very little to do with the quality of the advice we end up giving to people?
Totally.
Okay. So Marty and Barbara Nemco are here to give you some free advice. If you've got a work problem, or if not advice, to ask to see if like we can tease the advice to come from you. In any case, for a workover with no pummeling involved, the phone number here, work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4145. 4134. I'm seeing all these lines light up, so I'm not going to give out the phone number again. So let's go right to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can we help?
Hello. I have been accepted to graduate school. I'm a city planner right now, and I'm wondering if I'm making the right choice by going.
Okay. Well, certainly the degree of choice these days, if you're a planner with a bachelor's, and planners are hired mainly by government, and so the master's is considered. Are you going for a master's?
Yes.
Right. That's the standard degree these days. So putting aside for the moment the wisdom of getting it in terms of learning, because it's such a standard degree right now to have, and B, as a government employee, government more than the private sector is insistent on degrees. They're very worried about being racist, sexist, etc., and so they rely on degrees as a way of a kind of relatively colorblind approach to hiring and promotion. So especially if you're thinking about being upwardly mobile and getting a more responsible position and or moving to a different job, the master's is usually worth it. What's your but feel free to push back. What's your reaction in your particular situation to what I just said?
Oh, I was expecting there to be I was expecting your advice to be more critical of furthering education. That's a thanks. I mean, I was thinking I'm kind of stuck where I am right now and stuck in the place where I am because all my experience is in California and it doesn't really transfer elsewhere. And I'm stuck in the public sector and I'd like to try the private sector. So those are all the reasons I've got for taking the time out of my career to spend the 2 years getting the master's degree.
Yeah.
And you're just like your unreserved advice to just say go for it was really I was pleasantly surprised.
Two more nuances. You're surprised probably because you know I have a general predisposition toward not valuing a higher education as a training tool. But every person is different. And I would be really remiss if I let my predispositions bias me 100% of the time. Yes, I have a perspective. But when I listened to you, it sounded like in your particular situation, the master's degree was appropriate. One question additionally, though, to either confirm or refute that, there are some people who are school people who do very well in school and also enjoy the school process and enjoy the networking that accrues. Those are three things. Do you think you would do well in the program? B, would you enjoy it? And three, would you utilize it as the excellent networking opportunity that usually is?
I am really looking forward to it. In my undergrad, I was pretty lazy and unmotivated, but I'm looking forward to being surrounded by other people who are interested in taking advantage of all that, of all the knowledge. And I've promised myself this time I'm going to read all the books. I'm not just going to listen. I'm not just going to look at my lecture notes before the test.
Well, here I'm going to disagree a little bit. That's not the most important thing. If you were my brother, or my client, and I was sending, you were about to spend the big bucks in the year or 2 years of time that it's going to take to get that master's in planning, I would tell you that the keys to success are the following. No, be selective about what you read. Professors have this monomania, and here's where I'm getting a little critical of higher ed. They are almost narcissistic in their belief that this is so, everything they believe is so important. They're scholars, they're intellectuals. So they normally pile on these enormous reading lists because they believe it's so important, or they simply want to show to their peers how rigorous their course is. I would rather see you devote your efforts to being selective and reading what you believe will be important to helping you grow as the particular kind of planner you want to be, and devote more time to doing things like having study groups with people you respect, inviting people over to your house for a glass of wine to talk about issues in planning, to spend time to find an advisor in your master's program who you're particularly simpatico with and can talk about these issues, and also simultaneously perhaps get bonded enough with him or her that they would give you a lead on a great job afterwards. Those and getting great fieldwork and internships that are supervised with master practitioners in planning, those in my mind are the keys to making the most of the master's, not reading every word. What's your reaction?
Thank you for that. That leads into my next question. Can you recommend my plan is to go and bang down the door of these big international planning companies that make the plans, because the government kind of implements the plans, but the private company comes in, draws up the plan for the government, and that's what I want to do. Can you recommend how to get an internship or apprenticeship with them? I've tried cold emailing, and of course I've heard nothing back.
Okay, there's two things. Cold emailing will work often enough if it's done right. It's like any tool. A pencil is not good or bad, or a word processing program is not good or bad. It depends what you're writing. So if the letter is more thoughtful, intelligent, and making a great case, I'm going to just off the top of my head, I'm going to, you know, toss out one. So it's something like this. And I would find a specific individual person at one of those firms, not HR, because they're going to just blow you off, but an individual person is working at that firm, and you look at his or her bio, and you see that there's some either an interest that you share or a background you share or whatever. And I would write a letter that would say something like the following. Dear Mike, I've been a planner for X years in this organization, and I've been frustrated at the tactical nature of the work. It ends up being very much almost like a glorified clerk. I still have delusions. I'm 37 years old. I have delusions of having a bigger impact. And so I am beginning a master's degree at Golden Gate University, or wherever it is, in planning, and I'm eager to be sure that my preparation and my training is going to prepare me for a greater leadership role. I came across, you know, I know your firm is one of the eminent consulting firms in this area, and I noticed specifically that you have a particular interest in blah, and we both happen to have graduated from whatever. And I'm wondering, as I start this program, is there any advice you have for me as to how I can make the most of it so that I truly am prepared to assume at least an entry-level planner position in a firm like yours? That's not asking for an internship, but can you see how a letter like that, and maybe you wrote a better letter than that, there's the letter that I just kind of ticked off the top of my head. Do you think that is a potentially more helpful letter than the letter you sent to those folks?
That makes a lot of sense, because I still need to make the connection before I can get the apprenticeship.
There's an old Chinese saying that it says if you ask for something before a proper foundation relationship has been laid, your request will be not granted. It is premature to ask somebody for an internship or anything. It is appropriate at this point to say, I am a humble beginner. Please tell me, if you would, what you think I need to do. That is laying the foundation of the relationship. And then later on, if you have a conversation showing that you're just not self-absorbed and interested in yourself, but trying to really understand that person, because even if he is the vice president at this organization, everyone has issues. And if you can show a willingness to be equally of help to him as him to you, you are now going far to laying that foundation so that you can then later on at the appropriate point, either you're asking or more likely he will or she will offer you an internship because he realizes or she realizes that you are a person of substance. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks for the advice.
Barbara, you've been patiently sitting quietly. What would you like, if anything, to add to what I've just said?
This is your area of expertise. The one thing I absolutely loved that you said a little earlier was in graduate school study groups.
Mm-hmm.
Study groups are the least expensive, most powerful way to, number one, really reinforce your connections with people so you have an excellent network afterwards. And it's very helpful in terms of learning the material, especially for someone who bought a lot of the books but didn't necessarily read them.
A little polite disagreement / nuance. Everybody is different. Some people do really well in groups. Other people don't. And I will say I am terrible at that. I am not good in a group. I tend to be dominating. Why do I host a radio show by myself, basically, you know, with you on every 5 weeks? Because I feel like I have something to say, and I'm big mouth. I talk too much. So in a group, I tend to be dominating, and in which case I don't do well in the group. Or I feel like, okay, I need to be, be more socially conscious here, and I'll shut up, and then I'm feeling like I have duct tape over my mouth. So I'm not so, and I'm very driven, so I don't need the group to motivate me. So for Martin Nemco, I never join study groups, but bar other people, and so I want to turn to the caller. Knowing yourself as you do, would you be wise? Would you do well? Would you learn more? Would you contribute more? Would you have more fun? Would you be more motivated? You talked about not being motivated when you're an undergraduate. Would net joining study groups for you be a good idea?
I think it would. I think it would be. And that's what I'm looking forward to most is just being with other people who want to.
Fabulous.
Work with ideas.
Fabulous. Then Barbara's, as often is the case, she's right. So anyway, I want to thank you for the call and wish you all the best. And what I love, of course, is when callers, after you've tried some of this stuff out, I don't care if it's in 1 month or in 3 years, hopefully I'll still be on the air here, call back, let us know how it worked, what worked, what didn't work, would you?
Yeah, of course.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemco. Okay, let's go back to the phones. I'll give out the phone number again. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem of any sort, whether you're 16 or 76, whether you're self-employed, government-employed, corporate-employed, whatever, and you got a work-related problem, anything because you still don't know what the heck you want to be when you grow up, even though you're supposed to be grown up, or you just have an existential problem or a personal problem that's affecting your work life, all are fair game reasons to call. We promise, the one thing for sure, we promise to do our best to help. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Back to the phones. Your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Yes, is that me?
It is.
Thank you, Marty. I've listened to your show for many years. I was somewhat surprised to hear you say about anger that you yourself mm-hmm. have some problems.
I've struggled with it. Moderately successful, like high blood pressure. You can control it, but you can't cure it. I have a predisposition to anger, yes.
I have a question for you, I don't know if you'll feel comfortable discussing it, but in listening to the show, I've noticed that when you give advice to people about their jobs, you're very sympathetic, extremely sympathetic, empathetic, whatever, and you really work with them. When, as is the occasion sometimes, you discuss issues of, you might say, political, social, broader things, just mm-hmm. like, say, nuclear power or genetically modified food or something, or mm-hmm. or harassment lawsuits in the thing. In other
yes.
words, that don't relate to particular people calling up with a particular problem. I have a sense that you're shorter
yes.
with those things. Now, is that perception, is that one of the areas where you tend to be short, where there tends to be, you might call it, kickback?
Yes. I'll explain why.
Okay.
First of all, when I'm dealing with an individual human being, I have this almost secular, sacred belief that somebody's human life is at stake here, and it takes a certain amount of bravery to call, so I have this natural empathy for them. With regard to policy, there is less of a human being involved, but more important, I do have an internal tremendous, I have one of my foundational beliefs is that there is wisdom that reside across the political spectrum. And so I tend to, by nature, I am a moderate by nature. But when I hear hegemonic, like these dominant theories that exist here in the Bay Area, there's a lot of groupthink, and a caller kind of, especially, if the caller's intelligent, I don't care. But sometimes the callers are very self-righteous. They think they know the truth. And if I politely push back and they push back again thinking they're brilliant, that pushes my buttons because they're the combination of they're subject to the groupthink, they're not as bright as they think they are, and I feel a certain indignation that we are so subject to this groupthink and that pushes a button of mine, yes.
Can I make one observation about that? As someone who occasionally has kicked back about things, sometimes it seems to at least this one kicker backer that it's you who feel that you have all the knowledge. I only offer that for your consideration.
Yeah, it could be to be honest, for what it's worth. I am not I spend so much time, so much of my life thinking about and studying some of these issues. Let's take genetically modified organisms, for example. I was actually in a debate on them. And so in the course of, at this stage of my life, I reviewed the literature on genetic modified organisms. And I have a PhD in the evaluation of innovation, so I'm not your average person. So I've researched it very carefully. And I've also found out what the leading health organizations in the world nationwide have had to say. So if I make take a position on it, and then somebody comes in with their bumper sticker rhetoric, and then if I try to cite data or really authoritative source, and they still push back, I don't feel I opine about that which I don't have substantial. I love when a caller educates me about something I don't know, but when I do have a fair amount of knowledge and intellectual firepower to defend it in addition, and then they continue to push back, that does push my buttons, and I'm not, I don't know if it serves my listeners for me to simply say, well, that's another perspective. So there you go. I thank you for that. Was as honest as I can be. I tried to be as thoughtful as I can be about it.
I appreciate your openness.
I do my best. I promise you that.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Barbara, any comments you want to make about that?
Nope.
Okay. Do you think it was accurate what I said?
I do.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. The focus should be on you. How can I help you? How can we help you with whatever issue you are facing?
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you. I am a public school teacher. I teach English, and I've been working in the East Bay, and at one point I worked in the North Bay. And I've been looking around over the past 2 years for a community in a district that really resonates with me, where I feel I can work long-term. And there is such variety among the school districts. I've recently been hired to a new district, and shortly after I accepted the position, I kept interviewing, and I was getting a lot of phone calls and callbacks, and I received two more offers from districts that are more appealing to me. And I'm faced with a little bit of a sticky situation to resign from a position and to manage any fallout that comes from that. And I have some union support. I want to handle it quietly, and perhaps I was thinking of a phone call to the right HR person would work. And I do feel a little bit of I'm in a bind as a teacher. I don't feel that I have as much freedom to choose, and so I'm nervous about getting a bad reputation, I suppose, or causing extra drama. And the public school is a context where I want to grow and learn, and I also, and it has its benefits. So I have larger questions about, is this even a field of education that I should keep sticking with and dig my toes in deeper. So I suppose I need some moral support in one sense, and then a grander advice about public education in general.
Barbara, this is, I would think, a perfect one for you. Would you please take the lead in responding to this one?
I would think you have to do what's going to feel right for you. And you may irritate somebody in doing that, but you can't always make everybody happy.
Mm-hmm.
And you've already experienced what it's like to be in a district where you're not feeling as fulfilled as you could be as a teacher. So I would say go for it.
I'd like to amplify. I'm agreeing with Barbara, but in a different context. You know, I love to try to think what I call cosmically. I think about what is going to do the most good for the most people in the universal sense of things.
Mm-hmm.
Teaching is very difficult. Extremely difficult, especially in most of today's public schools that are mixed ability and with incredible demands on the teachers. You've got kids who are newcomers to who speak limited English, and those who speak good English, some with very severe behavior problems, some who are model students, some who are brilliant, some who are slow. You got everything, and you've got mainstreaming special ed kids are now mainstream most of the time, and you're told you need to individualize, and it is just an overwhelming task. So, and that's why still about a third of teachers leave within the first few years from the public schools. So, you have a cosmic obligation in my mind to the planet, to every human being, the potential students you would be serving, and to the people you'd otherwise be serving if you were in some other occupation. So you need to ask yourself, as you're deciding whether you should consider this option or that option or whatever, ask yourself which would do the most good for the children. And if in your heart of hearts you feel, you know, you just are not one of those, frankly, rare individuals who has the ability to first control the class, second, to individualize that well, third, be transformational in the way you get kids to understand stuff. You say, you know, maybe I'd be better off as a social worker. Maybe I would do more good. Or maybe, you know, because the kind of person who's a teacher very often wants to be that, you know, or work as a fundraiser in a nonprofit. You know, not everybody is meant to do any one thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you looked into your soul and asked yourself, what is the cosmically most beneficial choice you could make, what would it be?
Thank you. Thank you. Tomorrow is the day that I'm going to have some feedback from the union and I'll have them behind me. And but having connected with you today and having this decision tomorrow ahead of me, I feel really grateful, and I'm gonna keep that in mind.
But tell me right now, a moment. What if you were thinking about cosmic justice, if you were the wise woman within you, the goddess within you, your best self, what would you, instead of listening to the union, what would you tell the union tomorrow as to where you could do the greatest good?
Mm-hmm. I want to be in the district where I can live and be part of the community for a long term, so I know which one that is. I also want to be, two of the new jobs pay, you know, several thousand dollars more, so that's very important to me.
I will say that's trivial, because after taxes, the extra dollars on top at the top of a salary is you lose half of it in taxes. Please don't make the decision based on that. If it happens be the better school for you, for the better community, whatever, great. But don't let $2,000 a year, you know, or $3,000 a year color the decision much.
Okay, good point. Thank you. Yeah, the community, the longevity of being connected to the community is primary for me.
That's great. Barbara, I'd love you to get the last word. Is there anything more you'd like to add before we send off the...
No, think that she's come to a good conclusion.
Okay. Thank you very much for calling.
You're
welcome.
Okay,
thank you so much for the bravery of calling. We're calling the show. I appreciate it a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, you take care and be well. Okay. Instead of doing more letters, I promised the listeners at the top of the show, and I don't want to, I want to remember that I had gotten a letter from a guy who, or woman, I don't know, prefers to remain anonymous, and I'd like to read the letter, like we're going to turn around, like you were reading letters to me, so now I'm going to read a letter to you from this listener. It's about cube farms, about open workspaces, and I'm curious as to what your reactions are, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Right. By the way, dear listener, you listen to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. We've been doing workovers on callers, but we're now going to turn to a really interesting letter that came from an anonymous listener. Hi, Marty. Oh, he says, love your show. You made a comment today on your show regarding cube farms. You recommended to business owners who utilize office layouts that have high-density seating plans that they take into account how this is intrusive and disruptive for many workers. I had to chuckle, because just the other day, my brother was complaining about his chatty office mate and how his boss refused to allow him to expense a set of noise-canceling headphones, which only take the edge off a loud conversation occurring nearby. I said to him it could be far worse. I told him about my workplace, which has a densely packed open seating layout and where conversations are not just common, but even encouraged and practiced by all the leadership. They're often loud and spirited. During several hours almost every day, the sound level is comparable to a lively cocktail party or loud restaurant. At any moment, there could be a half dozen conversations ongoing within earshot. Again, this goes on for hours at a stretch on most every day. Being that you're near Silicon Valley, you ought to visit some companies where this is the case and sample the noise environment for your listeners. It shouldn't be hard to find. As I'm sure you're aware, this practice is followed at many startups and other companies that are trying to foster, quote, that startup work culture, the collaborative work culture. I'm sure Silicon Valley does not have a monopoly on this kind of office environment. I encourage you to bring your audio recorder and play a few minutes of it back on the air so people who've never experienced it would actually believe you. Now, the chatty people love this. In fact, whenever there's a lull in the noise level, one of them is going to invariably remark, oh my God, it's so quiet. They have grown so accustomed to the sound level, it's become the new normal. They can't even handle 30 seconds of silence without feeling compelled to break it. I'd love to hear your riff on this theme. As someone with a long and varied career in several types of work cultures and office plans, I'm continually amazed at this practice, and it seems to become the norm here in Silicon Valley. But on a positive note, at least we're busy as bees, although sometimes more like a swarming hive. Again, not that I'm complaining, I love my job, but on some days it does drain me more than invigorates me. And I think it takes an even greater toll on many people who don't thrive in such an environment but are afraid to speak up. I prefer to remain anonymous, so please don't share my email address. Cheers, Anonymous. Barbara Nemco, your reaction.
I can't imagine working in that kind of environment. I think it would make me crazy. I totally agree with what your writer is saying.
It is, to me, one of the sad side effects of this deification of collaboration, teamwork. Yes, there are certain tasks which are better done by teams, but this notion that it is worth paying the price of noise. Anybody would agree, and I'm sure there's a scientific literature that says that noise is distracting. And an open workplace in which there are, whether it's maybe he was exaggerating or not, six conversations going on at one time, cannot be constructive. When I work, and again, I don't mean to overgeneralize, but I know myself best, so I speak, from personal experience. When I have something unimportant to do, I might have soft music playing on the background. But when I have something important, like I'm writing my next Psychology Today article or whatever, or preparing for a client, I will never have even music on. And that's trivial in noise distraction compared to six conversations going on at one time. I think this notion that we again, it's part of the groupthink. We have this, we hate hierarchy now, that the modern society says we hate hierarchy, and we hate private offices because they're emblematic of hierarchy. And we dismiss individual contribution as like a cowboy, whereas collaboration and teamwork is inclusive. It tends to breed more diversity of ideology. We tend to deify collaboration, cooperation, etc. But we're so obsessed with some of these memes that we lose even the vaguest basic sense of common sense that, fine, if people need to meet as a group, there can be a conference room where people meet. We can encourage collaboration. But to mandate it to people and say, you are going to, every hour of your workday, work in this environment where there is all this noise, is, at the risk of hyperbole, strikes me as crazy. Barbara, is that, am I being hyperbolic, or does this feel legitimate to you?
I can't imagine that anybody justifies that in terms of it allows you to collaborate. I think what it does is saves a lot of money because you can squeeze a lot more people in.
No, that's different. That's true. If there are these wonderfully soundproof resistant high cubicle walls, which are cheap. Certainly, you're not saying about giving everybody an office. That would require more space, et cetera. But these are deliberately, there are no cubicle walls at all. They're just an open space. If it was a money, yes, if it's, some employers, yes, it is. The evil corporation trying to squeeze every last dollar out of the worker. Right, possible. But what I'm seeing more often is no cubicles at all. There's no attempt to create silence, but simply one big open workspace. That is not about saving money. That's about creating a culture of collaboration. You think I'm wrong?
No, I just don't have experience with that.
Yep.
So I don't know. I have seen that at some of the tech companies.
Right. Exactly where it is.
And that is exactly the place I would never want to work.
Right. Let's go to the phones. We have callers patiently waiting online. See if we can help them. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I agree with you wholeheartedly. The one thing you left out is that this sort of cubicalization of the workplace makes individuals feel dispensable and alienated.
Great
and
point.
Irreplaceable and ultimately, infinitely
replaceable. Yeah, the word is fungible. Like a fungible work product, like as though they're a part that you could plug out, like a spark plug, and put in another one in.
Yeah, but I have another comment to make based on what you were saying earlier about effectiveness and about your particular personal style, Marty. I've listened to you for many years and appreciated your feedback to people who are having work problems. That's where you're most effective. But when you start pontificating about personal points of view and then suggesting that people who disagree with you are just simply victims of groupthink, you're less convincing and your credibility starts to wane. And I would encourage you to stay away from that kind of homily, diatribe, opinion mongering, and using the radio program as a bully pulpit for your very distinct points of view.
Thank you very much for the call. Two things. First of all, I never just disagree for the sake of disagreeing. It's usually when I have made a point. And by the way, first of all, the show's absolute mission is twofold. It would be remiss of me to simply focus only on the micro. helping an individual. As we all know, the Bay Area mantra is think locally and act globally. So we do focus on the individual and their problems, but it would be utterly remiss and it would be a shallow show if I didn't also address the larger issues that inhere. And yes, sometimes you don't remember when I don't know about you, but there are times that my thinking is consistent with the zeitgeist, but when my thinking is not, and I certainly don't dismiss disagreement, like the previous caller who said he listened to me all the years, he has a very different set of foundational kind of political beliefs about the future of work, and I give him ultimate respect because he's a very, his response is a very intelligent one. But when I make a point and somebody makes a poor point and I then go and push back, quote, pontificate, that is to give both rational and empirical evidence that my position is at least worth listening to, that is worthy. That doesn't mean that's not intrinsically dismissive. It's appropriate in the supposedly free marketplace of ideas that we do express views that don't necessarily, especially if they don't comport with the zeitgeist. Because just to say this, hear the same old thing that you're going to hear on every radio station and every media doesn't add value to the marketplace of ideas. I like to think that I add particular value when my points of view, as long as they're reasonably well defended, both empirically and logically, to render those points. And if you don't, certainly don't have to agree, but I like to think that the full marketplace of ideas is where we should go. We have just a couple of minutes. Let's take one more call, and I hope it's only going to be about whether we can be of help to you, because right now, this whole show has been focusing not on the big issues, but on helping you as an individual. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can we help?
So regarding the open plan offices, the Brits have done a lot of research on this. Takeaway point is it's concentration is much more important than collaboration.
Right.
So rather than having an open plan where you have to go into a so-called focus room for privacy, it's better to give privacy and then allow people the ability to go collaborate in an open area when they want.
So precisely. Or in a conference
room.
Yeah. Barbara, if you were, let me call it, dear caller, so have you experienced yourself, forget about what's the British study, have you worked in both open and open workplaces, cube farms, as well as in private offices?
Yes.
And tell me, how do you believe your productivity has been affected?
Well, I am a person who takes, say, 15 minutes to really get into something and focus, so if I'm alone and it's quiet, I can do that and actually get a lot done in the hour. But if I'm interrupted five times, it's the myth of multitasking. I haven't gotten into the project. I've made a little progress, but much better to be left alone with some quiet, even if it's a person that I like that I'm sharing space
right.
with.
I think the operative thing is giving you choice. It's really ultimately pro-choice. If you are in a noisy environment, there's no choice. You can't escape. It's what you if you've got that open workspace thing. If you've got a small, at least a high-walled cubicle, you have the choice of having relative quiet, certainly, or wearing those headphones or whatever. But if you elect that you want to have a conversation, you can elect to have it. It just simply is anti-choice to have these open workspaces.
And actually, that very point was made by the British. It's the voluntary aspect of seeking privacy versus socialization.
Anyway, thank you very much for the call. Show's over, Barbara. We are out of time. So I want to thank you very much, as usual, for being my co-conspirator here on the show. And I also want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers, and I will talk with Jessica Ritter. She's the author of 101 Social Work Careers. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko for Barbara Nemko. Hi, Barb. I'll see you soon. You there? Oh, she hung up already. Okay.
No, I'm here.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, I just want to say I'll see you soon.
See you in a while.
Okay. This is Marty Nemko for Barbara Nemko, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.